Last time we met, a couple of weeks ago, we discussed the uninsured and issues and options around the uninsured. And I asked that you write a policy memo, which I think most, if not all, of you have done. And we're going to collect the policy memos when we break up into groups in the second half of the class. So when you break up into the group, your teaching assistant or me will be in the classroom there with you. We'll be back and forth, and you'll just hand it in at that point. And I'll talk more about the breakout sessions, and I've got a little sheet here for you on the breakout sessions that we'll use later in the hour. What I want to do for the first hour, hour and a half today, is talk about the Medicare Modernization Act and the debate that's ongoing now over coverage for Medicare beneficiaries for prescription drugs. That's what we're going to cover today during the first half. Then we'll go into the breakout session for the second half of the class. Then next week, we'll talk about managed care and the rise of managed care. The following week, we don't have class. I think the following week is midterm break. And so we will try to get, we will get back to you, these, the papers that you hand in tonight, we'll get back to you by the end of next week, so you'll have them before midterm break, because then there's another paper that's due, I think, on the 20th, something like that. Okay, any questions before we get started? Okay. Well, let me just recap for you quickly what we talked about when we were talking about Medicare a couple of weeks back, just to set the stage for the debate and the controversy over the Medicare prescription drug bill today. We talked a couple of weeks ago about how Medicare was enacted in 1965, about how Medicare at that point had two main parts to it, Part A, which covered hospitalization and inpatient costs, and was funded by this trust fund in which people paid in money while they were working, and then benefits were paid out to beneficiaries when they became Medicare eligible, and Part B, which covered outpatient care. We also talked about how in the mid-1990s there developed a crisis, a presumed crisis, an assumed crisis in the Medicare program. The presumption and the assumption was that the Medicare Trust Fund, the Medicare Part A Trust Fund, was going to run out by the early 2000s, and Medicare was going to presumably go bankrupt as a result. It wouldn't be able to pay its bills, at least Part A wouldn't be able to pay its bills by the early 2000s. We talked about the debate in the mid-90s between Clinton and Bob Dole, between the Democrats and the Republicans, over who had the better plan for saving Medicare, for rescuing Medicare from this crisis. We talked about following Clinton's election and re-election in 1996, Congress enacted in 1997 the Balanced Budget Act, which imposed draconian cuts in reimbursement for hospitals, home care workers, and nursing homes. And because those cuts were so draconian and so steep, Part A spending actually began to decline a little bit. And so instead of the trust fund disappearing by the early 2000s, indeed, and to the contrary, the trust fund began to grow and grow and grow, so that by the late 1990s, the debate was no longer over how best to save Medicare from this looming crisis. The debate instead was over what to do with the Part A surplus, with the trust fund surplus, particularly in an era in which the federal government was running surpluses more generally. We talked about how during the 2000 presidential campaign, Al Gore began by saying, among other things, Medicare ought to cover prescription drugs. George Bush responded to that relatively effective claim by Gore in the campaign. Bush responded by saying, geez, you know, 70% of Medicare beneficiaries already have some form of drug coverage, either from their, you know, former employer through a retiree plan or from a managed care plan or from Medicaid or from a Medigap policy that they purchased on their own or from a state pharmaceutical assistance plan. So Bush said, why should we worry about the 70% that already have drug coverage? let's concentrate on the 30% that don't have drug coverage, 30% of Medicare beneficiaries that don't have drug coverage. And Bush proposed that the federal government give the states $48 billion and that the states use that money to provide pharmaceutical assistance to low-income folks in their state who did not have prescription drug coverage. The debate went back and forth between Bush and Gore over that. Bush wins the campaign, wins the election, becomes president. Early 2000, Bush again proposes his $48 billion block grant to the states to provide pharmaceutical assistance to those elderly who didn't have pre-existing drug coverage. The idea goes nowhere. And I think that's pretty much where we ended up, where we stopped a couple of weeks ago when we finished class, and then, of course, last week, we switched gears and started talking about the uninsured. So what I want to do now is pick up the story from that point, really from the point shortly after Bush has taken office and seen his proposal to have state-based coverage go nowhere. So pick up the story from there, talk about the Medicare Prescription Drug Act that was enacted in December 2003, briefly describe the legislation to you, and then walk you through 9 or 10 or 11 issues that are on the table today as we speak about the implementation of that law. Walk you through what's going on with that, with those issues as we speak, so that you can follow these debates as they move forward. Any questions so far? All right. Let me see, make sure the recording is working. I don't know what I'm doing here with all my... seems to be working. Last week, thanks to somebody, I'm not even sure who it was, but last week I talked and talked and talked and was talking into the microphone for 2 hours and 45 minutes. Proudly the next morning, handed over the voice recorder to the back of my office, said, here's the podcast from last night. And she said, but you forgot to turn the on button off. So I've forgotten. So the whole thing didn't record. So thanks to someone in the class who actually had recorded it and gave it to Rebecca. So I think there was a recording available for you, but everything seems to be on. We'll see. We'll find out. I'll let you know. I'll just walk around with my various things here. All right. Bush gives up on his proposal to give money to the states, block grant to the states around prescription drugs. He decides instead, early in 2001, mid-2001, that what he wants to do when it comes to health policy and when it comes to Medicare is use the debate over prescription drugs, use the debate over whether or not Medicare ought to cover prescription drugs, to try to move Medicare away from a model of fee-for-service medicine, in which the Medicare agency, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Systems, the Health and Human Services, in which the federal government essentially acts as a single payer for all Medicare beneficiaries. Bush and his advisors think that's an antiquated, old-fashioned system which doesn't work well, which doesn't innovate well, and he says, you know what, in the rest of the healthcare system, we're moving to managed care, we're moving to HMOs, we're moving to PPOs, we're moving to all the things we're going to talk about next week in this class. And Bush says, I want to use this debate over drug coverage to push us to managed care. And so he changes his proposal around prescription drugs. He says, you know what we ought to do is say, all right, if you want to stay, if you want to receive prescription drugs and you're on Medicare, all you have to do is join a managed care plan. And Bush says in 2001, if you are on Medicare and you join a managed care plan, my proposal is we will provide prescription drug coverage for you. However, if you stay in fee-for-service Medicare, no drug coverage for you. So that becomes the Bush plan in mid-2001. That plan also, like his previous one, immediately hits significant opposition. There is in this country at that point, late 90s, early 2000s, a significant anti-managed care backlash, particularly among the elderly, which again we'll talk about more next week. And the notion of basically using prescription drugs as a lever, as a vehicle, as a tool for encouraging, incentivizing, pushing, forcing Medicare beneficiaries to move into HMOs doesn't go over very well at all. The Democrats, senior groups, AARP and the others oppose vehemently. Bush says this isn't about managed care, this is about markets and private health insurance, and private health insurance is more innovative, more responsive, and better than government-run health insurance. And so there's a bit of a standoff. During the midst of that standoff, we have the terrorist attacks of September of 2001. We have the recession that hit shortly thereafter. We have war that begins in Afghanistan and then Iraq. We have the federal government's budget surplus quickly disappearing and becoming a budget deficit. And all of a sudden, debate over Medicare, debate over prescription drugs, debate over expanding Medicare grinds to a halt. And throughout 2002, the focus of the Bush administration is almost exclusively on foreign policy, on the war on terror, on the war in Afghanistan, and then later in Iraq, and Medicare and drugs and all those sorts of things was off the agenda. Along comes 2003. And Bush is now beginning to look ahead to the election, which is going to take place in 2004, his campaign for re-election. The war has begun to bog down. It's not clear whether or not there's going to be any easy victories, particularly in Iraq. And Bush and his advisors decide that they need an important domestic victory. They need an important public policy victory here at home to both shift the attention and shift the agenda away from some of the troubles abroad. And Bush and his advisors say to themselves, well, why not renew our push for Medicare drug coverage? Recognizing that the proposal back in 2001 had gone nowhere, recognizing that the proposal to give money to the states for a block grant had gone nowhere, Bush and his advisors come up with a new idea, a third plan. And this idea is basically to say to people, you know what? Say to Medicare beneficiaries, you know what? If you want to stay in Medicare fee-for-service, in traditional Medicare, if you want to be able to go to the doctor of your choice, the hospital of your choice, without worrying about whether or not they belong to the network of your HMO, or without worrying about whether or not they belong to the network of your PPO, or whatever the acronym happens to be of the managed care plan that you're in. If you don't want to join managed care, but you do want prescription drug coverage, we will allow you to stay in fee-for-service Medicare and get prescription drug coverage by enrolling in a private prescription drug only health plan. Now, at the time, there was no such thing. Basically, there were no insurance companies whose sole business was to provide prescription drug coverage for Medicare beneficiaries. It was a market that did not exist. It was an infrastructure and a company that did not exist. But Bush and his advisors basically say, you know what? We will give Medicare beneficiaries a choice under our plan that we're now proposing in 2003. And the choice is they can join a managed care plan and get drug coverage through the managed care plan. They could stay in fee-for-service and get their hospitalization and their medical care through fee-for-service, but still get drug coverage through a prescription drug-only plan. Or they could just stay in the traditional fee-for-service Medicare program with no drug coverage at all. It's a voluntary program. And so that becomes the new format that Bush proposes in mid-2003. The event follows an extraordinarily interesting political debate. I'm not sure how many of you followed the political debate in 2003 over the Medicare drug law, over the Medicare Modernization Act, but there were very strange dynamics going on. You had very conservative Republicans, opposing the president on this, saying, why are we, you know, sort of the conservative Republicans who historically have been worried about budget deficits and entitlement programs and excess spending, etc., why are we, the Republican administration in Washington, talking about the biggest expansion in Medicare history since its enactment in 1965? So Bush had some trouble on the right. Among liberal Democrats, who for 30, 40 years had been talking about the need to expand Medicare to cover prescription drugs, among liberal Democrats there was some opposition to the Bush plan, basically saying, why should we, you know, when we're finally getting around to giving drug coverage to Medicare beneficiaries, why do we say you have to join a health plan, whether it's a managed care plan or a private drug plan? Why do you have to join a private health insurance plan to get that drug coverage? Why don't we just add drug coverage to the benefit package under the traditional regular Medicare package and forget about private insurance altogether? So the liberal Democrats oppose because they think this program that Bush is talking about is far too much of a giveaway to the insurance companies and the drug companies, and they think that basically it's diluting the traditional Medicare program, which historically has worked well over the previous 40 years. Conservative Republicans oppose them because they think Bush is acting like a liberal, talking about doing this big expansion, this big benefit expansion for Medicare beneficiaries. In between, though, sort of the moderate Democrats and the moderate Republicans end up forming a coalition in support of the Medicare Modernization Act. Very tough political battle. I don't want to go into it too much detail. And I'll tell you the truth, a number of liberal Democrats were really caught between a rock and a hard place because they had, for 35, 40 years, been saying we ought to do Medicare drugs. The Ted Kennedys of the world worried that were they going to be repeating the history of the early 1970s. Remember I told you in the early 70s, Kennedy and Nixon were both talking about national health insurance. Liberal Democrats opposed the Nixon plan because they thought it was too much of a giveaway to the insurance companies and the private sector, and they wanted a single-payer Canadian-style program, and an opportunity for national health insurance was lost, and it's been lost, you know, for the next 30 years. So liberal Democrats were also a little nervous that maybe they're giving up here, if they vote against the Medicare Modernization Act, an opportunity to get Medicare drug coverage that may not show up again for the next 30 years. So very interesting dynamics, very close vote. The House of Representatives approved the plan by a vote of 216 to 215. I mean, a very close vote. And that, there's actually, you know, there was ongoing litigation over the validity of that vote because they suspended the rules, the Republicans suspended the rules trying to find that final one or two votes, and there were allegations that promises had been made that was almost, you know, moved into the realm of bribery, and there were all sorts of political machinations going on to get that bill passed through the House of Representatives. But it passes the House, it passes the Senate, and in December of 2003, we have the Medicare Modernization Act. Let me briefly summarize to you what the bill says, at least what it says around prescription drugs. There's lots of other things that are included in that bill on everything from health savings accounts to all sorts of things. But I'm not worried about those, and I don't want us to worry about those tonight. Around prescription drug coverage, here's basically what the bill says. Medicare beneficiaries, 43 million Medicare beneficiaries, would be given the option to voluntarily enroll. It was not a mandatory program, to voluntarily enroll in what was now going to be called Part D of the Medicare program. Remember, Part A is for hospitalization, Part B is for outpatient care, Part C is for managed care, and Part D is for prescription drugs. They would be given the option of voluntarily enrolling in Part D. They would have a choice. Medicare beneficiaries have a choice. If they want to enroll in Part D, they can either sign up with a managed care plan and get all of their health care, including prescription drugs, from that managed care plan. Get the hospitalization care that they need, the medical care they need, the drug care they need, the lab care they need, etc. They can get everything through a managed care plan. Or, as I said a few minutes ago, they can choose instead to stay in fee-for-service Medicare and just get their prescription drug coverage through a new private health plan that would be created and would presumably compete for their business, for their prescription drug business. The drug bill made some assumptions, and these were just assumptions, and you'll see it didn't always play out the way... Happy birthday, Fallon. It didn't always play out. Oh, no, I almost feel bad. Fallon in this class, or no? Oh, I don't feel bad that much. Yeah, racist. It's like magic chalk. All right. But they made some assumptions about what the typical drug benefit was going to look like and how much it was going to cost. Now, we'll see later in the hour that these assumptions have not turned out to be true. But let me just put down for you, well, I can't write over this happy birthday. Let me just put down for you what the assumptions were. The assumptions were the average premium would be, for someone who wanted to join a Part D plan, would be about $32 a month. And for that $32 a month, what the average beneficiary would get would be the following. There would be a deductible of $250. So your first $250 of prescription drug costs, you'd have to pay for out of pocket. The health plan that you're paying this premium to would then pay 75% of your costs between $250 and $2,250. So when you incurred bills between $250 and $2,250, the health plan would pay 75% of those costs. The health plan would pay zero for your bills between basically $2,251 and $5,100. And then the health plan would pay 95% of your costs above $5,100. So when most people looked at this plan, they said, it's interesting. It turns out, under this scenario, how much do you pay? You pay your $250 deductible. Then you pay $500 of your next amount of money because this is the health plan is paying 75% of $2,000. You pay 25% of $2,000, so you pay $500 of the next $2,000. You then have to pay the next $2,850. This was the so-called donut hole, which you're responsible for paying for if you buy in. You pay the next $2,850. So of your first $5,100, you know, before we get to the catastrophic folks, people who have bills over $5,100 a year, of your first $5,100, you pay $3,600, plus you're paying $32 a month premium on average, right? So that's another almost $400. So if you're someone who actually incurs exactly $5,100, you will save $1,100 under this plan. On the other hand, if you're somebody who, I mean, you can, depending on where you fall in all of these categories, on the other hand, if you're someone who incurs about $12,000 a year in drug coverage, you know, you have huge catastrophic coverage, and the health plan is paying 95% of your bills over $5,100, then you're going to save a fortune on the plan. So depending on who you are and how you do, you're going to end up in a very different shape. A few other things that the health plan, that the Medicare Modernization Act said. It said for people who are on Medicaid right now, the so-called dual eligibles, and there's about 6.2 million of them. They're on both Medicaid and Medicare. Those folks have to be switched from Medicaid to Part D. They're no longer going to get their coverage from Medicaid. Instead, they're going to get their coverage from Part D. The bill also said that people who have income below 150% of the poverty level will get subsidies to help them pay that'll cover either all or most of these various payments. So one group that the bill actually is pretty good for is for low-income folks. So you get subsidies to pay for most of your premiums and bills. The bill also said, and again, I'm just going to run through a few of these provisions, not expecting that, you know, we'll go into all of them in depth right now, because I want to come back to them when I talk about the dozen or so issues around implementation. The bill also said that if you work for a company that provides retiree health coverage to you, so that you're now getting prescription drug coverage from General Motors or from your former employer, if you're in that boat, the government wanted General Motors and wants General Motors to continue providing prescription drug coverage to its employees. It doesn't want General Motors to drop drug coverage for its retirees, because then all of those folks would go into the Part D plan. So basically, the bill also said the federal government will pay a subsidy of 28% of all costs between, I think, $250 and $2,000. $222.50. The federal government will pay 28% of all those costs to the private sector if they keep folks in their current drug plans. So this was about a $71 billion program. But that's the basic model. I mean, that's the basic model. You get to decide whether or not you want to join this drug plan. If you do, you either join a managed care plan or you join a prescription drug-only plan. The thought was this is what the benefit package was going to look like. As I said, it's turned out not really to look like this that much, but that was the expectation. There were some special provisions around the dual eligible, around the low income, around people who work for, you know, companies that had that were giving them retiree coverage. There were a zillion other small, some very important provisions in the bill, but this is that's the basic overview. Any questions on the basic overview? Oh, one other piece of the basic overview that I forgot. I'll just add one thing and then I'll open it up for questions. One of the things the Democrats were pushing very much for during the debate over the Medicare drug bill was they were saying, you know, the federal government should use its leverage as a buyer, as a purchaser, to go to drug companies and to tell the drug companies, if you want to sell to the Medicare population, you have to give us really deep discounted rates. You know, you got to really lower the cost quite significantly. And in fact, the VA has a pretty good, the Veterans Administration has a pretty good record of getting pretty low drug costs, drug bills. And so, you know, the Democrats are pushing hard to give the feds the right to negotiate with the drug plans. The Republicans said that would, and Bush said that would undermine completely the effort to move toward a market-based system. That would be a regulatory system in which government would set drug rates, and that would be terrible because if government controlled the cost, if it controlled the reimbursement rates to drug plans for Medicare beneficiaries, then that would mean basically that the federal government was regulating the rates of drug companies more generally. And, you know, Bush and others argued that would be, you know, end to innovation in the pharmaceutical industry, and it would be horrible, etc. And so the bill, among other things, prohibits the federal government from negotiating rates. All of the rate negotiations with the drug were going to be between the health plans and the pharmaceutical companies, between Aetna and Pfizer. or whatever the case may be. They would work out their own grades. Yeah.
Is that why a lot of, like, with the different drug plans, the fact that most of the beneficiaries are going to be generic and support
the inability to negotiate this? Well, that's a question about how it's all playing out now. So let's, I mean, when we start talking about how it's all playing out, we'll come back to that. The very quick answer is there's an unbelievable variety right now of, I mean, in fact, many say too many plans, too many options, too many benefits, etc. So depending on how much you want to pay, you can get a generic-based health plan, you know, which is going to cost you basically nothing, or you can get, you know, a better plan that's going to cost you a lot of money. I mean, it's really played out differently, I think, than the drafters thought it would. Okay, any other general questions before we get into how this is all played out? Yeah. Well, basically, the idea was the government didn't want General Motors dropping its coverage. So what the government said is as long as private coverage you have right now is equal to or better than the basic coverage that we're paying for, then we will provide the subsidy to you to pay you the employer for part of it. So in a certain sense, what the feds did was they didn't want to compete with General Motors. They wanted General Motors to keep giving coverage. And so the idea was let's pay General Motors. Instead of paying 100% of the drug bill for the General Motors employee, let's pay 28% of the drug bill so that General Motors continues paying 72%. That was the theory. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so it wasn't any kind of individuals to look at the Part D and say, oh, they're not my General Motors coverage.
Well, individuals have the option of dropping. You know, any individual who wants can join Part D. I think, you know, the idea was you wanted to encourage people to stay where they were. I mean, from, you know, the more people who have, what Congress wanted and what the President wanted was as many people as possible to have drug coverage, but they wanted as many of those people to have private sector drug coverage that they were already having. So the more people who chose to leave General Motors and come to Part D, the unhappier the federal government would be. That's why they said the General Motors coverage, in order to get the subsidy, has to be at least equal to, if not better than, the drug coverage that we're offering. So that in theory, there'd be no incentive to join our plan. Yeah. The question was, what was the average spending on drugs per year by a Medicare beneficiary? You know what, let me look for that. I have that number in my notes here. I don't recall the number offhand, but generally speaking, Medicare beneficiaries and the elderly use drugs and utilize drugs at far higher rate than do the rest of the population. And the rate was going up rapidly among that population. And so to the extent that you didn't have drug coverage, you were in significant trouble if you were an elderly person. But I do have that note, so come off at the break and I'll pull that out. Basically, the rationale was, well, now that's a hard question to answer. What Congress did, and this is a very sort of interesting part of this, they said, they started out by saying, we want a drug bill that's going to cost around $80 million, something like that. And so they started out by saying, we want a drug bill that's going to cost around $370, $380 million. And so what kind of benefit package can we get for that amount of money, their initial presumption? Then they said, you know what, who do we want to help the most? And they said, really, number one, we want to help the most people who have really catastrophic costs, you know, really high costs. But if we help people with really catastrophic costs, you know, the money's going to have to come from somewhere else. And we also want to help people who have relatively, you know, if we look at the majority of beneficiaries, either they have very catastrophic costs or they have relatively low costs. So by the drug plan paying 75% of the costs between 250 and 220, and the reason that's 75 and not 80 or 70 is just a question of doing the math, you know, with the amount of money they have and the actuaries. So they said they wanted to focus their efforts on people who have relatively low drug coverage and people, you know, help them a little bit, and people with relatively catastrophic incidents. And where that leaves some big trouble are people in the middle.
So it wasn't because of that most people were in the middle?
No. All right, so let me tell you,
How does 28% provide an incentive if they just stop and get 100%?
Right, I think the theory, the thinking is, you know, there's long-standing relationships between General Motors and their unions and their workers, and between these big companies and their workers. And a lot of companies are dropping retiree coverage right now, but they're doing it reluctantly, and it's causing great ill will among employees. And so the thinking was, you know, the big companies are going to want to keep the promises they've made, in effect, to their workers, because that's part of the goodwill that they've generated with their workforce. And if they just dump all their workers into a government program, that's not going to be very popular. But on the other hand, they need, the theory was, the thinking was, they need a fiscal incentive to do what was considered to be the right thing. And so the way they came up with that money, that amount, was, again, they said, how much of the $350, $400 million we're going to spend on this program can we actually pay to employers, you know, to keep people in their current situations? And they essentially came up with about $70, $75 billion they said we could pay. And so so then they had to figure out what $70, $75 billion would buy, and it would buy about 28%. All right, so let me walk through now some of the key issues. The first issue that was on the table was, will health plans participate? Now again, today, when we look at a situation in which you've got dozens and dozens and dozens of health plans participating, you might say, what's the big deal? Well, as recently as late 2003, early 2004, there was a real fear that managed care plans would not play in this game, and that there would be no such thing as a prescription drug plan that would be created. There was a real fear that there would be no competition, that they'd throw a party and nobody would show up. So in fact, they included in the bill a provision known as the fallback provision, which basically said that if you lived in a region where there were fewer than two health plans in your region, the federal government would make sure that there was what was known as a fallback plan, which would probably be a government-run, or it wasn't exactly clear how it would play out, but the federal government would have to guarantee there'd be at least two plans for everybody. So that's the first thing the government did. It said, all right, we're really nervous about whether or not we're going to have enough health plans participating in this, enough managed care plans, enough other kind of plans. But we're going to guarantee there'll be at least two. Every Medicare beneficiary will have at least two plans. The federal government then said, all right, let's try to give some incentive to health plans to participate. And they gave them an incentive to participate. Here's how the incentive works. Plans had to bid to participate in this program. Plans were worried that they were going to lose money on this deal, because Medicare beneficiaries are old, or many of them are sick, they have high costs, they didn't know brand new program, how do you estimate it, etc. So the way the bidding process works is, say you're a health plan and you want to participate in this game, and you estimate that your costs are going to be $100. It's going to cost you $100, and say you decide that this is the benefit package you're going to give, you're going to offer. If you say it's going to cost you $100 to basically give that kind of coverage to Medicare beneficiaries, you bid $100. say you happen to be just an average plan. I mean, you're exactly the average. The federal government takes all of the bids. You know, one group bids 110, one group bids, two groups bid 100, and one group bids 90. You know, one plan. One plan bids 90 to 100. So the average is $100. The federal government will then give $75, will pay $75 to all four of these health plans. And the difference between what the feds give and what the program will actually cost is what you charge as premiums. So in this case, if it's really going to cost you $100, the premium you're going to charge to beneficiaries would be $25. On the other hand, if you bid 90 and they give you 75, the premium will be 15, and if you bid 110, etc. The math is too hard. You can figure it out. But then the federal government said, you know, so you're basically working out. I'm good with whole numbers. Let's do 125. So you basically then have the first year of your plan. You know, you've estimated it's going to cost you $100. The federal government's given you 75. You've gotten $25 worth of premiums from the beneficiary. At the end of the year, lo and behold, it cost you 110. You were wrong. This was a more expensive program than you predicted. So in other words, you've spent $10 more on average than you thought you were going to spend. Well, the federal government decided, because they wanted to encourage health plans to participate, that at least for the first few years of the program, they would share that loss with you. In other words, they would put a cap on the amount of money that health plans can lose by participating in this game. Similarly, if it turned out that it was a lot cheaper to cover the people, it didn't cost you $100, it only cost you 90, so you've really made $10 more than you thought you were going to make when you handed in your bid, then the federal government says, but we're going to take some of your profits in that situation. So what the feds did was they basically put some boundaries around how health plans would do. You know, they put a sort of a maximum gain and a maximum loss on it. But from the health plan perspective, that was a great thing. Why was that a great thing? Yeah, because you're going into this, you're Aetna, or you're some, you know, Medco, you've never had a plan before, you know, you're brand new, you think of going into this, and you're just afraid that you can get killed in this whole thing. You know, geez, you're going to provide a prescription drug-only benefit plan to people over 65 years of age who could voluntarily choose to join your plan? I mean, how do you estimate how much that's going to cost? And so that's one of the reasons that early on everybody was afraid nobody was going to join, nobody was going to play the game. But the feds set up the bidding process, so that in fact there would be no really bad losers. You wouldn't lose a lot of money. You could win a lot of money. I mean, maybe the feds would take some of your profits, but generally you could win a lot of money, but you couldn't lose a whole heck of a lot, at least early on. And so that fact, combined with the fact that here's 43 million folks who are potential customers of yours. This is the biggest new market opportunity in a generation. And what a lot of plans said is, you know what, I'm not sure if we can make a lot of money if we do a prescription drug-only plan, but if we can get people into our managed care plan, then we can really save money. Then we can really make money. You know, we don't know how much we're going to make if they're in a prescription drug-only plan, but if we could get them to join our managed care plan so that we're in charge of their hospitalization, we're in charge of their physician care, we're in charge of their labs, x-rays, everything, that, and we'll talk about this in the next couple of weeks, that historically has been a very, very, very profitable business for managed care plans. And not only that, the federal government also said we're going to increase the rates that we pay to managed care plans for their general managed care business in the Medicare market. So the Aetnas of the world were getting more money, the rates for the managed care were going up, and their losses, potential losses in the drug world, were bounded. So all of a sudden, instead of, you know, worries about two plans, all of a sudden you had a situation in which in every region of the country, there were 40, 50, 60 health plans participating. And many of those health plans said to themselves, geez, we don't like this model that Congress came up with. We don't like the donut hole. We don't think that's going to sell to our customers. You know, we don't think it's going to sell to our market. And we want to offer choice. And so a lot of plans started saying, you know what? We want to be able to offer our health, our potential enrollees a zero premium account, a zero premium business with us. Now, the ones who offer zero premium are usually HMOs, or managed care plans, because they also figure they could take a little bit of a loss in the drug plan. But if they get people to join their managed care plan, in other words, if you join, I'm making this up, but say Aetna has a plan, and if you join Aetna, you may get the drug benefit at a zero extra premium. Aetna may actually lose a little bit of money on the drug plan, but they're going to make so much more money on the managed care plan that it's worth it to them to have a little bit of a loss leader there almost. Plus, there's an insurance company called Humana. It's a private insurance company that historically has marketed itself primarily to working class and middle class folks in the Midwest and South. Big plan. Humana basically has worked out a deal with Walmart. And so if you go into, and Walmart is one of the biggest prescription drug companies, and not prescription drug companies, has one of the biggest pharmacies, you know, pharmacists in the country. So if you go into a Walmart, you'll be encouraged to sign up with Humana. Humana basically will offer you a prescription drug only plan, like at a premium of, say, $2 a month. Now, for that $2 a month, you may have a very high deductible. You may have, you know, no access to brand name drugs, only generic drugs. You may have a donut hole. You know, you may have not the greatest coverage in the world, but you get coverage for $2 a month. Now, whether or not this is actually going to, now what Humana is hoping for, then Humana also has plans, you know, for say $30 a month. And for the $30 a month plan, maybe there'll be, you know, the $2 a month plan could have a big deductible, you know, donut hole, all those things. Maybe the $30 a month plan has no deductible and allows you brand name drugs, you know, much more expensive. But they also want to convince you to join their HMO. That's what their game is here, not the prescription drug only plan. They want to convince you to join their HMO. Let me read you one thing about Humana. One comment that was just made. This was made by one of your former classmates. So I figured what would happen. A guy named Matt Borsch, who graduated from the School of Public Health a couple of years ago. Well, I guess it's probably been 5 or 6 years ago at this point. Who now is a top analyst for Goldman Sachs. Oh, here. And so basically, he was commenting. I saw this in the Wall Street Journal. He was commenting on the Humana plan. And he says, Matt Walsh of Goldman Sachs says, either they've figured out something the others haven't, or they're pursuing a reckless strategy. So in other words, they're pricing very, very low now on this prescription drug only plan. They're not giving many benefits, but they're really pricing very low. Whether or not they're going to, one of the big questions is whether or not all of these plans that are now in the game are going to survive financially, whether they're going to make it, or if there's going to be a big shakeout in a couple of years, in which plans just are losing so much money they're not going to make it. I think what Humana is betting is that they could get you in at $2 a month and then either get you to a more expensive plan or get you into their HMO where they're going to make money. But nobody knows really for sure how that's going to play out. Right now, instead of $32 was what Congress expected the premium, the average premium to be. Instead of that, right now, the average premium nationally is $25 a month. So it's $7 a month cheaper than was expected. Relatively few plans are following this model here. Instead, there is just a laundry list of benefit packages out there with premiums ranging from zero premium in some of the HMOs and $2 a month in some of the PDPs to $50, $60 a month premium. I mean, you can really pay a lot in premium and have no deductible, no donut hole, brand name coverage. You know, basically, this is America. You know, you get what you pay for. And that's the way this market is working out. There's a huge market out there, lots of plans. Now, whether or not these plans are going to survive, who's going to win, who's going to lose, who's going to have market share. I mean, Humana is signing up a lot of people right now at Walmart. United Health Plan is number one right now in enrollees. Who knows who United Health Plan has an alliance with? Who do they work for, United Health Plan? You're all so young. AARP. No AARP members in here? Come on. United Health Plan is the official health plan of the American Association for Retired People. So if you call up the AARP and say, what should I do about this new Medicare drug bill? They're going to say, join United. In fact, they get money every time you join United. You know, there's I mean, that's one of the reasons AARP has been their role in this, because they both play a role as a policy advocate for the seniors, but they also, with United, are a partner that sells health insurance to seniors. So anyway, that's pretty much the question on whether or not health plans will participate. A lot more health plans than people thought, and nobody knows quite who's going to stay in the market and how it's going to play out. We'll know a little bit more in June of 2006. Because in June of 2006, all the plans that are now in the market have to decide whether or not they're going to bid again for 2007. So if they've been losing their shirt, well, I actually think it's a little too soon for a shakeout, to tell you the truth. So most of them will probably stay in for another year. But by 2008, we'll see who stays in the market and who's out of the market. And it'll also be interesting to see whether or not new players submit bids in June of 2006 to participate in 2007. It's really going to be interesting to see how that dynamic plays out among the health plans. Now, one of the things, again, that you have to watch for also is, remember, one of Bush's goals early on, was to use the prescription drug benefit to try to encourage people to join HMOs and managed care plans. And in fact, that is playing out right now. Because again, remember, the HMOs got big rate increases. And for a lot of reasons, the HMOs in general, because they could subsidize some of the costs, the HMOs are, in general, significantly less expensive to the consumer than the prescription drug-only plans. And so what does that do? That creates an incentive for people to, I mean, if you're trying to figure out what to do, you've got a financial incentive now to join the HMO. And so there's an issue, a concern, people are wondering whether or not that's going to mean that HMO enrollment among the Medicare population is going to significantly rise over the next year or two. We'll have to see how that plays out. Actually, that leads me to the second big issue. Issue number one was were health plans going to play? Issue number two is, were Medicare beneficiaries going to play? Would they sign up? So the second issue I want to talk about is, will beneficiaries enroll in the program? Now here, the federal government and Congress has very high hopes and expectations. When the plan was passed in December of 2003, and when implementation first was being talked about, The goal was, by the way, I don't know if I mentioned this, while it was passed in December of 2003, implementation didn't actually begin until January of 2006. So the years 2004 and 2005 were startup years, getting it all together, getting, you know, bids, figuring out how it was going to work, et cetera, et cetera. The actual program itself, enrollment in the program, you were allowed to enroll if you were a beneficiary in one of these programs, I think beginning in November, but the program didn't actually begin until January of 2006. So we're talking about a program that's been in place for less than 2 months, has been operational for less than 2 months. The administration's hope is that by the end of 2006, between 39 and 40 million out of the 42, 43 million Medicare beneficiaries will either be enrolled in a Part D plan or have some equal private alternative like credible retiree coverage. So the idea was almost all, about say 40 out of the 43 million, would have drug coverage, either from the federal government or from their former employer, or their current employer, if they just happen to be over the age of 65. So very high expectations. On the other hand, Congress and the federal government also knew that there were going to be obstacles to getting that many people to sign up, because it's a voluntary program, remember. You don't have to sign up. They knew that if indeed this was a standard benefit plan, this would not seem attractive to a lot of people. They knew that there was a significant cost that you would incur in signing up for this program. And if you were age 65, you were healthy, and you used about $400 of drugs a year on average, you'd end up paying, $700-$800, and you'd get nothing back because you never would meet your deductible. And if it was voluntary, and you could wait till you got sick till the next year to sign up, the thought was, geez, why would you sign up if you're a young elderly, relatively healthy? So what did Congress do to try to encourage Medicare seniors to sign up immediately? Yeah?
Did they say that if you don't sign up by a certain time, there's going to be consequences in terms of financial consequences?
There's going to be consequences. Right. It's going to be hell to pay. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. What Congress said was that, and this is still the case, if you're on Medicare right now, you have until May 15th of this coming year. So you have about another March, April, May, 3.5 months to sign up for one of these plans. If you don't, and you don't have to sign up, it's okay if you get your coverage from your retiree plan and it's an equivalent plan and they're getting subsidized, then this rule doesn't apply to you. But if you don't have alternative equal coverage and you don't sign up by May 15th, you're going to be penalized. So that, and say the reason you don't want to sign up is because you're 65 and you're healthy right now and you figure, what the hell, I'll wait till I'm 75 and sick. Well, if you don't sign up now by May 15th, you pay a penalty of 1% premium every month, increased every month, until you sign up. So maybe, if you don't sign up by June 15th, it's not going to be too big a deal, because you only have a one-month penalty, 1%, if the premium was $25, 25 cents or whatever is going to be your penalty every month. But if you go a year, 2 years, 3 years, and every year you're incurring an additional 1% penalty, so that, down the line, you're paying 20, 30, 40% more in premiums than anybody else, and then you get sick, then you're screwed. Then you're in trouble. So the idea was to really impose a significant fiscal incentive on people to sign up now. Yeah. Well, that's one of the big questions going on today, right now, is enrollment, as we'll talk about in a few minutes, is lower than expectations for a variety of reasons. Although it's been picking up, but it's lower than expectations. The Democrats right now are submitting legislation in Congress and are proposing that May 15th deadline be extended at least till the end of the year. The administration is opposing that, saying you got to have a deadline, basically, and that that deadline is going to force people to sign up the closer we get to the deadline. And that if you extend it till the end of the year, people will just wait till the end of the year. Whatever the new deadline is, there'll always be people waiting. So that's the back and forth. But the Democrats are saying there's been so much confusion and upset, nobody knows what's going on, et cetera, we ought to extend the deadline. The administration saying as well, right now, saying, well, at a minimum, let's wait and see. Because we still have 3.5 months to go. Now, if you were a Medicare beneficiary right now, I won't make any of you who are beneficiaries raise your hand. But if you were a Medicare beneficiary right now, or actually, I'd be curious. And this, I'm actually serious on this. If, whether or not any of you have, you know, since you're all in a school of public health and you presumably sort of follow this stuff, you take, you know, do any of you have parents or grandparents who've been getting things in the mail? And because my sense is they're getting a lot of stuff in the mail. Go ahead, yeah.
Yeah, I was just going to say, like, my father is getting stuff in the mail. And, like, I read the Medicare review book, but, like, I don't really think he is getting it
right
yet. So it's, so I feel like I have to keep trying to understand it.
Right. Yeah. Anybody else? Yeah. And is it your sense that the material she's getting are making it clear that she has till May 15th to make the choice before doing the penalty?
Yeah, she knows that.
She knows that.
Yeah.
So somebody else going? Yeah.
My mother gets benefits from her prior employer.
Okay.
And because I knew I had to make a decision, it was made easy because I got a letter that said from her, from the company that she was working for, that the plan that they were offering was better than the Medicare Part D, and that you didn't have to do anything
right
to change.
Right. So she's one of those who were, so they're going to just take the subsidy then, that company.
Right. I didn't know until you said so, that they were going to subsidy for doing that.
Right. Yeah.
This is more of a question. Are these information that's being sent out in other languages, like Spanish?
Yeah, I mean, there's a multiple number of events and activities going on right now. I mean, sort of advocacy groups and activist groups and community-based organizations in a whole host of communities are trying to work with the seniors in their community. The federal government, I know, has been sending out a lot of materials. I honestly don't know what languages they're sent out in. Does anybody know? I would assume that it's available in Spanish, although I actually haven't seen it one way. Okay. One of the questions, though, is, you know, what do people understand? Well, first of all, let me just sort of say, low-income folks, if you're on Medicaid right now, if you're on Medicaid, you are automatically converted as of January 1st to Part D. And if you've been reading the newspaper about a lot of the problems and controversies around the implementation of this law, a lot of those problems and controversies surround Medicaid beneficiaries, because they all of a sudden, basically in one night, in one day, 6.2 million Americans were taken off of their Medicaid plans and put into Part D. A lot of those folks then showed up at the pharmacy the next day and said, I'm here for my prescription. The pharmacy tried to look them up in the computer, and they weren't listed in the computer. So there were several hundred thousand, at least, glitches, if not more, hundreds of thousands of folks who were supposedly switched from Medicaid to Medicare didn't show up in the computer system. The question then came up, what should pharmacists do and what should states do? 28 states said they would guarantee to the pharmacists that if they just gave prescription drugs to those folks, you know, who said they were on Medicaid and maybe had a Medicaid card, but, you know, didn't have proof of being on Part D, that the state would pay the bill, regardless. So because this became such a controversy, New York and 27 other states are basically paying bills right now, and the federal government has promised the states that ultimately it'll make sure they're reimbursed for all the money they're out. But there was a huge, huge snafu in terms of getting people signed up who are the dual eligibles. Go ahead. just to, we say this is only for Medicare beneficiaries, Part D. So if you're not a dual eligible, then the only people who could sign up for Part D are Medicare beneficiaries. Those who are also on Medicaid were automatically converted from supposedly and presumably, and the intention was to convert them from Medicaid to Medicare Part D on January 1 of this year.
Well, my question about that is, what if they can't afford the deductible?
Well, there's no deductible. I mean, if you're on Medicaid, remember again, for the low-income folks, the deductibles and all those stuff is waste. The problem for the dual eligibles isn't the deductibles, although I should say that there's no deductibles, but there are some copays. And so one problem is there are some copays, so some Medicaid beneficiaries are struggling with the copays. And that more generally relates to the question of the fact is that the Medicaid drug benefits in most states were pretty generous. That's why when we were talking about Medicaid, when we were talking about Medicaid cost containment, I was saying most states were looking to cut their, you know, pharmaceutical spending because they had pretty generous programs. So the Medicare Part D plans are generally less generous than people had on Medicaid. So Medicaid beneficiaries are getting less generous coverage. Plus, the assignment of those 6.2 million folks was all done randomly. And so people were just randomly assigned to plans that were participating in their region. But then every plan, and we'll talk about the formularies in a minute, but every plan has its own formulary, its own, you know, drugs that it covers and drugs that it doesn't cover. So you're the Medicaid beneficiary, you've been taking Lipitor, I don't know, whatever you've been taking for the last, you know, 5 years, then you're assigned to a drug plan under the new Medicare bill. You then show up at the pharmacy. Maybe the pharmacy doesn't even know you're on Part A, Part D right now, and they say, we don't have you listed as Part D, sorry. But even if they have you listed as being in a plan in Part D, it could be the plan that you've been assigned to isn't really the best plan for you. It doesn't cover the drugs that you really need. If you're lucky enough to have a daughter or a granddaughter, an advocate, who says to you, you know, there are other choices, other plans, you can switch plans. Some of those Medicaid beneficiaries are switching to plans that they belong to, or they're trying to seek exceptions to the formulary rules, but there's a huge snafu with all of that stuff right now. Well, you can choose if you want at this point. They assign you initially, and then say, but if you don't like the plan you're in, you have the right to change. But again, most people, most dual eligibles are elderly, indigent, sick. You know, they don't really know what plan to join or what plan not to join. And so they've ended up just being assigned. Way in the back, I think, somebody here.
I'm a little unclear on the benefit program. Because I'm
like, well, say this deadline stays the way it is right now, and it's May 15th. I mean, nobody's been charged yet because the penalty hasn't taken effect yet. But say it's now June 15th, and you never signed up. And then you say, oh my gosh, you know, I never signed up. It's June 15th. You know, I want to sign up. And say you sign up for a plan that has a $25 a month premium. Well, you're going to have to pay a penalty. And, you know, it's a very good question. I'm not sure whether that 1% goes to the plan or to the federal government. I honestly don't know where that 1% goes, where that balance goes. But you pay a penalty either to the plan or the federal government. I'm sure they know, but I just don't know the answer to that. For every month, the penalty keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. The idea was to basically try to push people into this right away, because you didn't want people staying out while they were healthy and only joining when they got sick. The goal was to avoid adverse selection.
So are there guaranteed issue laws? What about people who, for example, have a pre-existing condition that might make it hard to sign up for a plan?
Anybody can sign up for any plan. For certain folks who are considered high-risk folks. Remember when I said here that basically if you've estimated you costed $100, the feds give you $75, and then you charge $25 in premium? Well, if you can show that you've got some high-risk folks in your plan, you get a bonus. You get some extra money for those folks. There's all these complicated formulas that sort of go beyond what we want to do in here. But there's an effort, in theory, to try to acknowledge and take care of the fact that some plans may end up with a sicker population than other plans. So there's some risk adjustment efforts that are in there. The trouble is risk adjustment's kind of in its infancy. And so the health plans have been suspicious that it was going to work, which is why they like the fact that their loss is bounded, because that really, you know, means that if they end up with a much sicker population than that, and the plans also said, you know what, 2-3 years down the line, we'll have more experience, we'll know who's signing up with us, we'll be able to give a much more informed bid. But for the first couple of years, we want some protection. And the government agreed. Yeah?
I understand that you eligible to announce
which
funds of Medicare experience
increased
benefit.
That's what I was just saying. It depends on the state you come from. I mean, it could well be that if you're on Mississippi's Medicaid program, you're actually better off right now. On the other hand, if you're on New York's Medicaid program, you could be worse off right now.
Right.
And it also depends on your own individual situation and what drugs you're taking and whether or not they happen to be covered or not. But on balance, the fear among advocates is that they're going to be worse off. Whether or not, and so far, they've certainly been worse off because there have been all these screw-ups. Whether or not a year from now they'll actually be worse off, particularly in an era in which Medicaid programs were cutting back anyway, who knows? But anyway, were you going to ask a question about that, or was that?
Well, I was just curious about what kind of other, not necessarily drugs, but other more basic drugs that are covered by Medicaid,
or Medicare. Medicaid has a much more generous benefit pack. I look at nursing home care, long-term care.
Exactly, and so that's based on how people are still eligible to be in.
Absolutely. No, I mean, I'm not sure.
I'm not demonizing anything. I'm just saying that it's just, I'm curious what's going to happen in this.
Well, they're now on sort of Part D Medicare, and exactly how that plays out, we don't know. I mean, we honestly don't know. Mm-hmm. You know, the argument is that there's now sort of a standard national plan which sort of equalizes the playing field. Another issue, just to sort of jump ahead, was this has created a lot of tension between the states and the federal government, this plan, because the states were paying, you know, as you know, between 20 and 50% of the cost of the dual eligibles drug costs, because states contribute between 20 and 50% of the Medicaid bill. So at first, when the states found out that the feds were going to take all these people onto Part D, which is paid for with 100% federal dollars, the states thought this was going to be a big fiscal bonanza for them. They were wrong. What did the federal government do to sort of eliminate that fantasy? The federal government created a program called the Clawback Program, which basically said that if you were a state, that 90% of any savings you have, because we've switched people from Medicaid to Medicare, 90% of those savings you have to give back to us, the federal government. The states actually believe that they're going to be worse off under the new Part D. They're going to end up not only paying 90%, they're going to end up spending more than 100% back to the federal government. They're going to be worse off under this program than they were beforehand. So, for example, just last week, the state of California announced plans to sue the federal government, claiming that the new Part D program was unconstitutional and that it discriminated against the states in a variety of ways. And other states are thinking of joining in that litigation, etc. One and two.
I'm just curious, while this plan was being considered, was there any kind of conversation around how, if you know, the people were being penalized versus the companies were getting paid? Like, I just think that's a little weird to me, a little upsetting. Because, like, you know, here people have to pay for all this, companies are totally getting, totally subsidized around getting this plan together and all of this kind of thing. The states are having less money to, possibly less money to give to their own
government,
to their own people in those states. Like, was any of this even considered?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a lot. I mean, a lot of the dilemma that, say, I don't want to generalize too much, but say sort of a liberal Democrat type might have over this bill is, on the one hand, they might say, well, geez, this is going to be this big giveaway to pharmaceutical companies and managed care plans and whoever you want to think, insurance companies, etc. On the other hand, there are a lot of people, and I don't know about you folks' mothers or grandmothers or whoever, there are a lot of people who are going to be better off under this plan than they are before. I mean, there were millions of Medicare beneficiaries who had no coverage for prescription drugs at all prior to this bill, who now, particularly if they're relatively low income, I mean, if you're below 150% of the poverty level, but you weren't on Medicaid before, you were poor, you couldn't afford drugs, you got nothing. Now you pretty much have your all of your drugs subsidized by the federal government. If you're a middle-class person who has been unable to afford a Medigap policy for drugs, you may well be better off now. Plus, I think an argument could be made, that just getting the right to prescription drugs enacted into law, setting that as a base, and allowing advocates and others to argue about where we go from here and how we fix the system and how we clean things up, is a lot better off than having sort of defeated the bill in 2003 and still having no drug coverage at all, and saying with the new budget deficits, it's not even going to come up on the agenda for another 20 years. So it's not at all clear. And in fact, what I'm going to do, you know, in 10 minutes or so when we sort of stop this conversation to go on break, I want to actually take a poll of you. I'm going to ask you to raise your hand and ask how many of you would have, if back in knowing what you know now, back in December of 2003, how many would have voted for this bill and how many would have voted against it. I'm just curious as to what, so you can think about this over the next 10 minutes. I'm curious as to what, you know, your vote counts, every vote counts, you know, what you think. The Medigap plans were plans that people used, well, Medigap are private insurance plans that people buy to fill in the gaps between what they get from Medicare and what they need. It used to be that you could buy drug coverage through a Medigap plan. Now that Part D is in place, Medigap plans are no longer allowed to sell drug coverage. Did you have, I think over here, did you have a question again?
I had a question kind of on the state level. You said with the tension there, I'm kind of curious, when they enacted the law saying that the federal government couldn't negotiate with drug companies, was that only for Medicare, and was that only the federal government? And can states still negotiate, and can the federal government negotiate on other drug plans that's not Medicare, like could it be Medicaid or
yes.
down the line?
Yes. The states, in fact, one of the reasons the states are upset about this new bill is because not only are they going to be losing financially in that all the money they save, you know, they lose all these Medicaid beneficiaries, they get switched over to Part D. They lose them. Then most of the money that they're saving from that, they have to pay back to the federal government. Plus, they've lost most of their leverage for the under 65 population, because the most expensive members of the Medicaid population are now no longer covered, get their drug coverage through Medicaid. So when Medicaid, one of the big strategies that a number of states have been engaged in recent years is to try to pool together their purchasing power to try to negotiate with drug companies to get lower prices and lower deals. States have lost a lot of their leverage right now. But absolutely, states negotiate. The Veterans Administration at the federal level negotiates. The military negotiates. You know, there's lots of negotiations that go on. But you cannot, under the law right now, the federal government cannot negotiate for the 43 million Medicare beneficiaries. Again, the argument is what some people would say was, geez, if you've got one person negotiating for all the 43 million of those folks, you're going to get a much better deal. The counter-argument is that's going to be regulation of prices, and so you have a more decentralized market in which each individual plan does its negotiations. You know, sort of, and that's why even today, I mean, if you talk about what the Democrats are proposing in Congress, you know, they've been arguing for the last 3 years, and they continue to argue today, that the right to negotiation, being federal negotiations, should be put back or put into this legislation. Yeah?
What did you say the difference is between what the administration said that Part D would cost and then actually...
Okay. This is actually an interesting story. Let's see if I can get the documents. When the bill was enacted in December of 2003, the Congressional Budget Office said that the bill would cost $395 billion over 10 years. And that's pretty much the figure that Congress used to create that benefit plan. You know, that's pretty much the figure they used when trying to figure out how much this whole thing was going to cost. You may or may not remember, but a few weeks after the bill was passed, there was a big controversy in early 2004 because it came out that the chief actuary for CMS, for the federal government, had written memos and other things estimating that the bill was actually going to cost $534 billion, not $395 billion, and members of Congress were very upset that they hadn't been informed of this CMS price. It's interesting, the head of CMS at the time was a guy named Tom Scully, and I had an interview with him on another project the day that a New York Times editorial came out basically saying he should be thrown in jail for hiding this fact from the federal government, from Congress. And he was completely unrepentant. He spent an hour basically telling me why he was right. It took me an hour to actually get to the topic I was supposed to be there about. So CMS says, back in late 2003, CMS says $534 billion, CBO says $395 billion. Okay. In 2004, a year later, the CBO says the bill is actually going to cost $849 billion. And CMS, at that point, says it's going to cost $720 billion. Now you say, well, how could the cost have doubled in a year? You have to remember, these are all just guesses. They're guesses based on how many people are going to sign up, how many are going to sign up in HMOs, how many are going to sign up in PDPs, what's the utilization going to be, this, that. So anyway, let me just run through the numbers, and then...
Are you saying a billion or a million?
Billion.
A billion.
Billion. Okay. Right. So in 2004, the CBO, this is expensive, providing prescription drugs to 43 million folks cost money. All right, 2005, CMS, CBO, let's see, let me just read this, okay. Okay, in 2003, CMS said 530, let's just use the CMS numbers for now, forget CBO. Nobody knows, but the CMS in 2003 says $534 billion. In 2004, CMS says $720 billion. 2005, CMS says $737 billion. And just a week or two ago, CMS has come out and said, actually, it's now down to $678 billion, their estimate, over 10 years. In fact, they're saying in year one, instead of costing $38 billion, it's only going to cost $30 billion. And why do you think their estimate for year one and overall is lower right now? Because the plans are coming in with low bids, so they're going to have to pay less money to the plans. So there's been this extraordinary range of estimates as to how much this is going to cost. And these are all expert actuaries who you would think would know what they were doing. But what they're trying to do is predict how much utilization a population, many of whom have never really had much drug coverage at all, that's average age is, I don't know what the average age is, but from 65 up, you're talking about what's the utilization of an older population that's now going to have access to insurance for drugs for the first time. It's just guesswork. But of course, as the price tag has gone up on this, from 395 to 800, now to 700, whatever the numbers are, billion over 10 years, you can imagine that many in Congress have said, geez, we thought we were voting for a $400 billion program. And then you've got some conservatives in Congress who said, we oppose this, saying $400 billion was way too much. And now you're telling us it's going to be $700 billion. Now you can imagine what sort of the, this is, and so you could argue that if you're, and then of course it gets complicated because the liberals say, well, geez, it's $700 billion, but too much of that is going to General Motors, and too much of that is going to Pfizer, and too much of that is going to Aetna, and not enough of that is going to Sheila or whoever. The liberals say more should, there should be fewer subsidies, that if you just ran it through the government instead of running it through these health plans, it would be cheaper and there'd be more for the beneficiaries. On the other hand, not all of it is going to, I don't care what your politics are. Not all of it is going to Pfizer, not all of it is going to Aetna, and not all of it is going, to some insurance company or some drug company. There's going to be a lot of money that is going to be used by beneficiaries on prescription drugs that haven't been used before. So, it's going to be, whether or not, what percentage that is of the actual amount of money, who knows? And what utilization is going to be among the elderly population, who knows? And what kind of health impacts this is going to have. The rosiest impacts suggest, well, geez, you'll save money, because if you get folks, particularly elderly folks, access to prescription drugs that they need on a timely and preventive fashion, you can you know, avoid and delay them ending up in the hospital with some serious and significant and expensive situation. We don't know. We really don't know how that's going to play out. Let me tell you real quickly what the numbers are like right now. As of February 13th, so as of 2 weeks ago, there were 15.9 million Medicare beneficiaries that were enrolled in Part D plans. All right. Of those 15.9 million, 6.2 million of them were the dual eligibles. Another 4.8 million were folks who were in Medicare managed care plans, most of whom, but not all of them, many of whom, but not all of them, had previously been in a managed care plan that simply added the drug coverage right now, but some of whom have actually just signed up for the first time with the managed care plan. So 6.2 million dual eligibles, 4.8 million in Medicare HMOs, and 4.9 million in prescription drug-only clinics. So 15.9 million in one of those three kinds of plans. There's another 10 million who've got alternative coverage, mainly through their retiree health plan or you know, veterans or whoever, federal government. So altogether, is almost 26 million out of the 44 million, 43 million on Medicare, about 26 million right now who either have Part D coverage or have some equivalent alternative coverage. Remember I told you that the hope that the federal government had was that by the end of 2006 there would be 39 million. So that means another 13 million would have to sign up between now and the end of the year. Now that's possible. We don't know. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of distrust out there among seniors. There's a lot of confusion out there among seniors. There's a lot of fear out there among seniors. There's a lot of concern out there among seniors. On the other hand, more and more seniors are beginning to realize that if they don't sign up, they're going to be penalized. How it's all going to play out, we don't know. As I said, the Democrats are pushing now to expand beyond May 15th, the open enrollment period, without a penalty. Whether or not that's going to happen or not, we don't know. Let me see, it's 7 o'clock. Let me just see what other things I want to talk about. I don't want to take too much time on this. A lot of private companies have been signing up. I know one other thing I wanted to talk about, where there's a lot of confusion right now. Two areas where there's a lot of confusion in the last few weeks, and then I'll come to you in a second. One has to do with formularies. As I said, every one of these health plans has a formulary, has a list. A lot of people are signing up for plans and not realizing exactly what's in the formulary for their plan, what's covered and what's not covered in their plan. One of the things that there's the biggest debate about these days is neither pharmacists, nor consumers, nor doctors seem to be taking advantage of guarantees that the federal government put in place in the law that give people the right to request a hearing to get an exception to the formulary, or that give people the right to get drugs that aren't on the formulary if they get prior authorization from them. So there's a big debate as to whether or not those rules are just, you know, rules on paper that nobody's going to take advantage of, that basically set up systems and that, in fact, people are going to end up with formularies that don't help them, that end up keeping them from getting drugs they need, or, in fact, over time, if doctors and pharmacists and beneficiaries will become much more savvy and end up. You know, the debate over formularies is an interesting debate, because it's a debate in which, on the one hand, you've got consumer advocates and drug companies are on the same side in this debate. You know, both consumer advocates and drug companies want as extensive and expansive and as open a formulary as possible. And on the other side, you have the insurance companies, the managed care plans, and the PDPs, and they want as narrow a formulary as possible. Lots of confusion about formularies right now. In theory, every health plan is supposed to have at least two drugs in every class of drugs that the federal government has set forth, big confusion as to how that's playing out. Again, given the time, I don't want to get into detail with this on you, but big confusion. Another area where there's huge confusion right now has to do with these subsidies for low-income populations. Remember I said people at 150% or below the poverty level are entitled to subsidies. Well, a lot of people either don't know they're entitled to those subsidies, they don't know how to apply for those subsidies, they're not applying for the subsidies even though they should be applying for the subsidies, and sometimes they're not getting the subsidy, they're being turned down even though they shouldn't be turned down. A lot of controversy over the subsidies. So if you read the papers these days, you'll see a lot of controversy over what happened to the doula eligible, a lot of controversy over the formularies, a lot of controversy over the subsidies, and even the administration is agreeing it's been a bit of a fiasco in its early implementation. That's why Bush didn't mention the drug program in his State of the Union address, for example. I mean, he didn't mention a word about this huge new program. On the other hand, the administration and Leavitt and McClellan and the folks in the administration are taking the position now that these are early initial implementation problems. And so if you think about the debate around Medicare managed care, around Medicare drugs, the debate is really, are we seeing sort of short-term implementation issues that are not surprising given the depth of the extent of the program, or are we seeing something that's got more fundamentally flawed because of the way it's structured, and that while some of the short-term problems will eventually be fixed, the longer-term, more structural, more, core problems will not be fixed unless Congress fundamentally changes the program. Let me ask right now, if you were in Congress in December of 2003, by a show of hands, and I guess you don't have to vote, you can refuse to vote by not raising your hand, how many of you would have voted yes to this legislation? All right, TAs, look around. You're going to be my vote, not exact vote counters, but okay. All right, how many would have voted no? It's pretty close. I think the yeses had it by a little bit. It was pretty close. All right, we're now going to break into groups. It's 11 for the small group session. So let me tell you what we're going to do. Actually, we'll hand these out in the groups. What I've got here is an assignment. Let me have your attention for just 2 minutes. Just listen to me for a couple of minutes. Well, on this sheet of paper, and we'll put on the blackboard, each group is going to a different room. In your room, first you'll give the TA or me your paper. But then you're going to have a discussion about the uninsured. You're not going to be wearing the hat of whatever group you represented. You don't have to wear the Aetna hat or the Chamber of Commerce hat or the Kennedy hat or the Bush hat. This is what you think. I've listed on a piece of paper here 13 options for helping the uninsured. Each group is required to pick 3 options that they think are the best 3 options, and what we should be doing right now. So the most realistic and best political strategy for helping the uninsured. They're required to pick 3 options and then list in bullet points why they picked those 3 options. You'll then email your options and bullet points both to the TA in charge of your group and to me. And what I'm going to do is then I'm going to organize it all, not tonight. I mean, then you'll go home after you make your choices. I'm then going to organize it and post it all on Courseworks or whatever and send you all, just to give you a sense of the variation. This is really just an opportunity for you to talk about the uninsured and how you think we ought to deal with the issue and the problem. We'll hand this out in your group, in your rooms. Why don't we start up there, maybe like 20 after 7. You go till you're done. Whenever you're done, you go home. You go home at 8:30 at the latest. Why don't we have you guys write down on the board the rooms, but also when you go to your room, you'll have these there as well. Okie doke, thanks.